Hello, welcome to Series 1 of Peak Trans, the new podcast where I, stand-up comedian, writer, hot sex icon and trans woman Jen Ives, sit down with a cisgendered guest to talk about the state of trans issues in the United Kingdom today. For Episode 1, I spoke with the Leicester Mercury Comedian of the Year 2017, Alistair Beckett-King. I mean, I was in the Leicester Mercury Awards at one point. I was in the final, but I mean, I didn't win, but whatever. Alistair is a sketch writer, a podcaster, a video game developer, an animator, and just for today, an uncomfortable straight white man being forced to confront the societally ingrained transphobia of which he is solely responsible. I hope you enjoy listening to the conversation, and make sure you subscribe to the podcast because we've got about 10 more of these coming up for Series 1, and some of them are real hot TV personalities. Anyway, it's going to start now. You can follow me on Twitter at Jen Ives Comedian, and you can also follow Alistair Beckett-King at Mr. ABK. Welcome to Peak Trans. Thank you for being a part of it. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's all right. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. Do you know what Peak Trans means? Do you know where the name comes from?
This is like a quiz. Well, yeah. Let's see if I'm right about this. I think I said to you before we started, it really feels like I'm doing my GCSE in woke.
Yeah,
but I haven't done any revision at this point, so I really feel like there's a lot at stake.
Well, no, there isn't.
I'm
not testing you. This is quite niche stuff. I mean, this isn't even like woke stuff. This is quite in crowdy. I don't expect you to actually know, but I would like to hear what you think it is.
I think it's a phrase used by the gender critical, as they like to be referred, and I'll use the term gender critical out of respect for how they prefer to be described.
Yeah.
The gender critical movement to describe when a trans person, normally a specific individual on social media or Tumblr or something, says or does something particularly ludicrous, which of course happens all the time because the internet is giant.
You've got it.
Full of oddballs.
You got it in one. That's great. You're well on the way to getting an A star in wokeness. Yeah, that's
yes!
Really good. Good job.
Yes. I was joking to begin with, but now that the prospect of doing well has arrived, the nerd in me has come out, and I really want that A star.
Well, I think what's actually happened is that you have always known what peak trans means. I think you possibly coined the phrase, and I'd like to know what your peak trans moment was. When did you finally have enough of us?
It hasn't happened yet, but we're not that far into the podcast, so it could be you at any moment.
I did consider that. I did wonder if I was going to do more harm than good. Do you see? I mean, I am aware that it's quite often in the news and stuff, but how much of it do you see? Like, do you feel like it's being spoken about quite a lot at the moment, or is it just me?
Yes, I think it's. I think it. I try to do the reading. And I've tried to appraise myself. I've tried to make sense of the different and conflicting arguments.
Yeah,
I think that from my point of view, the referendum or the consultation on gender recognition certificates in the UK a few years ago appears to have kicked off the backlash.
Yeah.
Because it was not long before that when. Sort of liberal media institutions were patting themselves on the back for, you know, sort of saying, well, trans people are here to stay. That's all done and dusted. Time to take a large sip of tea. And then suddenly the backlash seems to have come out, and the controversies around toilets or bathrooms, as Americans wrongly call them.
Yeah, they do wrongly say that.
Seems to have kicked off. In the UK, in this mad island we live in, where we're in the weird situation of a significant portion of the feminist left, it's wrong to say that, a vocal portion of the feminist left taking a position that in the United States and other English-speaking countries would be a very rare position among left-wingers.
Yeah, it's one of those strange things where it feels like it's a very British issue at the moment. I know it does happen, and it is talked about in the States and things, but there seem, even from sort of like cultural commentators that I've heard in the States, it seems like they're looking at us in Britain as kind of like a what not to do at the moment in regards to it.
Which is weird, because in other political areas, we just get it right every single time, don't we?
I mean, whenever
every other issue. We had to get something wrong eventually. Britain had to make its first mistake.
Sure.
It's just bad luck that it had to happen to be trans people.
It was bound to happen at some point, and I'm happy to take the fall. You know, that's what we're here for.
That's very noble of you, because I think it's important that we protect Britain. That's crucial.
I think I wanted to talk to you about it though specifically because, you know, I see your sort of like your Twitter output and things, and although you don't talk directly about trans stuff as much as me, I'd say you do touch on related subjects. Like, you talk a lot about cancel culture, whether you're sort of like making fun of people who decry it. So it all seems kind of adjacent. Like, I know that you've had things to say about Comedy Unleashed and things of that nature.
I have been somewhat snarky about Comedy Unleashed. I did do a gig at Comedy Unleashed.
I wanted to ask you about that, actually.
I've avoided talking about it. And in fact, I've refused to talk about it on a podcast in the past when it was more fresh.
Yeah.
It was long enough ago in the past.
Am I going to get an exclusive?
It doesn't pertain particularly strongly to peak trans issues. Although there were people doing transphobic jokes.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you.
The weird thing about that is the two types of... There's a lot of weirdness about... I should say, I don't think my Twitter output is particularly political. I do make the occasional snarky comment, but my politics is far too earnest and sincere. I don't actually have that many funny jokes to make about politics.
Oh, yeah, but maybe that's why when you do say something that's slightly political, maybe it stands out more. I don't know. Maybe that's why. I'd be
nervous of speaking with any authority when it comes to transition. Although I am very interested, but I also know that. Because it becomes a philosophical issue,
and it's
full of people doing thought experiments with other people's real lives, and the other thing that happens an awful lot with any rights issue, I mentioned that I'm a vegan, is that people will start coming up with outlandish analogies, which usually involve throwing some other historically maligned minority under the bus just for the sake of making an analogy. There is nobody who understands less about trans issues than me, but I have made an effort to try and understand things.
Well, by default, if you've made any effort to understand, I think there are definitely people who understand it less than you.
Perhaps. I think what I mean is that I came to it from a position that's probably quite a gender critical position. And I came to it, my innate experience of gender is very similar to the way people the way I see transphobic people describing their experience of basically saying, I don't have a gender identity.
The thing is, right, I have had a little bit, not criticism, but some people have said to me, well, why are you doing a podcast where you're talking to just loads of like cisgender, not trans identified people? And I said, well, because I'm genuinely interested, to be honest with you, like on your point of view of the issue, because a lot of this stuff is quite insular. You know, I talk to a lot of trans people about sort of like what's going on and what their opinions are. And I hear a lot of theories and things like that from us. But I don't talk to many sort of cisgender people about how much they know and what they think about things. And so when you were saying about you come at it from a sort of introductory gender critical point of view, what do you mean by that?
I come to it with an ideologically gender critical perspective, but
no.
That my understanding was, you know, from sort of university days onwards, that gender is essentially socially constructed. And there isn't an immediately obvious overlap between gender is a social construct and the idea of people having a gender identity. And so what really threw me for a loop, is that a phrase? I'd always been broadly supportive of trans rights without knowing any details in general. As a sort of an axiomatically, it's progressive left-wing people should be allowed to do that, these sorts of things without the state getting in the way of their lives. When Rachel Dolezal was revealed to not be black, she claimed to be transracial, which is a troubling term, I think, because it is already a word that has a specific meaning that isn't a white person who becomes a black person.
Yeah.
That was used as an analogy to attack trans people.
Yeah.
I saw that being used quite a lot because it's an obvious example of someone saying, "Here, look, I have become something that I am obviously not." Mm. And in doing that, take on physical qualities and also a sort of a weight of social baggage. I'm sort of stepping into oppression she's stepping into oppression by becoming a black person. Mm. And it's weird and confusing. And a lot of people I know said, well, there's obviously no comparison. They're obviously different because race is socially constructed. And that confused me because my understanding was that gender was also socially constructed. So what I came to very confused. I thought, well, if gender is not socially constructed, are we then talking about there being such a thing as men's brains and women's brains and those being innately different, which I think is not true. And there isn't, or at least there's not much evidence for men's brains and women's brains being innately different. So I was stuck on what is gender identity, because I'm not aware of having one. So I didn't innately know what experience people were describing. Okay. That was a really long answer.
No. It was really, really interesting and really like thoughtful. The Rachel Dolezal thing is stressful because
I also don't know how to pronounce her surname.
I think it's Dolezal. Again, I'm not.
Is that what I said? I don't know what I said.
I think you said it. I think you said
sorry,
it right.
Carry on.
No, it's all right. But I think for me, like, although I'm not going to go so far as to say I understand why people make the comparison. I think it's one of those sneaky things. It's like saying, look, here is an example of something that looks sort of similar to what you are doing. This is how gender critical women or, you know, certain women feel. This is what you are doing to them and their culture and things like that. I think my point of view on it has always been, and I have to stress that I'm in no way, you know, a biology expert. But from what I do understand about sex in particular and the way that, you know, sex develops with a baby in a belly, medical terminology there.
Well, you're blowing my mind here.
Yeah, I know. And the way chromosomes work, you know, there's always potential for either a boy or a girl. And also there are chemical reactions that happen at that stage that are ambiguous sometimes, you know? And yes, gender is largely socially constructed. I mean, it is. But it reminds me sort of like of I read Gender Trouble by Judith Butler. Have you read Gender Trouble?
No, I've only read very short passages of things by Butler, and only very recently. But she sounded great.
Oh yeah, it's a really.
Although I've
really,
heard
really
that she's
book.
Very hard to read by reputation.
Well, Gender Trouble is not too bad. It's not Derrida. It's all right. It's doable.
I will not read French philosophy. A very inquiring mind, but I'm simply not interested in what French people think about things. Sorry.
No, I understand. You don't eat French sticks either, do you? You're not interested.
I won't eat French sticks. I won't do French kissing. Nothing French. I won't have any of my cabinets French polished. I am
no
consistent.
Mustard.
Absolutely. In my anti-France stance.
And it rhymes, which is absolutely lovely. I foresee a T-shirt in the future.
Who would have known that's what I'm getting cancelled for? The anti-French bigotry in this.
It's a classic. I mean, you know, it's coming back in a big way.
Please continue.
Yeah, but in Gender Trouble, she basically talks about, it's not surprising in a book called Gender Trouble that she talks a little bit about gender. But she talks about how, you know, in her, and I might be butchering this, I don't know, because I am a bit of a dummy, but in my perception of it is that she was saying, you know, she wants to live in a society where, it's that whole thing where, you know, when people say, oh, there are so many genders being created, you know, there's genders coming out of the woodwork, there's this gender and that gender and this gender, and it's confusing. Well, the reason why I think that is and why what Judith Butler sort of says is that because there's no one convenient sort of descriptive word to bracket any one person under, you know, it's there's always things that we differentiate on. And what would be better is in a way if there was like a sort of a label for everybody, you know, something for everyone, but it doesn't logically make sense, you know, it's not comprehensible, it's not digestible, it's impossible really. So the more reasonable way to go is the opposite direction, right? Well, then there's no gender, but people have things that they hold on to with gender and things like that. So this whole conversation, it's like a mix between sex and gender and general confusions between the two and just an unwillingness to move. I mean, the other problem with separating sex and gender, I find, is that there then becomes this dialogue that's like, oh, you know, gender is societal, so therefore it's wishy-washy, and sex is scientific and rigid and factual and inescapable. But yeah, you know, the truth is, I don't think sex is that. That's not what I would view it as. I think sex itself is also based on man-made definitions, based on observations about the way that we see the world. So, well, I'm just saying it's biological categorization, isn't it? And there's a lot of room in that for variance. So,
yeah, this is the kind of thing that I get very interested in and never get a chance to talk about. So apologies if this podcast goes on for another 2 hours.
It's absolutely fine. As long as you've got the time, I'm happy.
But I certainly think, now I've said that, I've forgotten what I was going to say.
Talk about French people again. We're dealing with lots of different people who have lots of different ideas about what it means to be a woman and what it means to specifically. And there are people who are hung up on literal dictionary definitions as if the dictionary is in some way illegal.
These dictionary fuckers, I haven't got much time for that because the dictionary is a descriptive book that explains how words are used.
And different dictionaries have also different meanings.
How you ought to use words.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
But there is, you know, like, if I can be permitted an analogy, when equal marriage legislation was on the cards, people were saying, they're trying to change the definition of marriage. And campaigners were saying, no, we aren't. But I think if we're being honest, by allowing gay people to marry, you probably are changing many people's understanding of marriage and probably literally some dictionary definitions of marriage. You probably are changing the meaning of marriage. But marriage is obviously socially constructed. So we understand that we're in charge of what marriage can be.
Yeah.
But I think there are... I have read good faith, philosophical, gender critical pieces where people really do try and think about it and still end up gender critical. And I don't agree with them, but they have at least made an attempt to think about it. But I think much more of the conversation centres around the sort of the, for want of a word, the J.K. Rowling version of it, which is quite sincere, I think, but also very badly sourced, utterly without evidence and full of genuinely sincere fears it's a very tricky thing when someone presents genuine fears that you don't believe to be grounded in reality, because the fear is real, but if the thing that you're afraid of is not real, how seriously should that fear be taken? Because I can't say that's nonsense without insulting you, but I can't also take your fear as evidence that the thing is real.
Well, unfortunately, I think sometimes this might, I don't know, maybe this sounds cold, but you know, in that kind of every action has a equal reaction sort of thing. J.K. Rowling, some of her fears are I'm not going to say that they are correct fears to have. Like, I don't think her actual fear of trans women at large is a rational fear. But I understand what you're saying about you don't want to trivialise people's genuine concerns or life experiences. But it was interesting to me because you said that, you know, it comes across quite sincere. I think unless I'm being blinkered by my own sort of like bias, to me it doesn't come across that way. Just to me,
that's interesting.
Yeah, and maybe that's,
I should say, I think it's a poorly written piece.
Well, there's no excuse when she's a much celebrated author, I think. I would also go the opposite way on that. I don't think it's poorly written. I think it's quite dog whistly, and I think it's interestingly written. I think it's written in such a way as to try to seem caring and sensitive to trans people to a degree, and also to dog whistle certain causes within it. And that's just my perception of it, you know. I think it's the thing about J.K. Rowling is, but I don't think she realizes the weight of sort of like the position that she has. I think she's aligned herself with certain groups who are known to be damaging groups. They've kind of built their reputation already, and the fact that she's chosen to align herself with these specific groups, to me it says more than just her concern. So it's very difficult for me to sort of be like, oh yeah, she's, I think she's just, you know, slipped up on her words there, because I think it's more calculated.
No, I think you're right in that. I don't think she's made any mistakes apart from the mistake of writing it. I don't think she's made any mistakes in writing it. I think what I find odd about it is that the credit that is extended to that piece by sort of, say, Guardian columnist types, you know, the political centre in Britain, if those same genuine concerns were, I'm going to have to use another analogy, we allow on the centre-left, we allow arguments about trans people that we would never allow about when it came to immigration. We would never use someone's sincere fear of immigration as evidence that immigration is out of hand. An argument happens all the time on the right. You know, genuine fear of whatever foreign group you're afraid of is the beginning and sometimes the end of the story. We would never allow that argument on the left because we understand that statistically there isn't much evidence to show that immigration is bad for the country. But we do allow it for when it comes to trans issues, which seems to me to be inconsistent, because in principle the argument that I'm afraid and my fear is real and you must respect that isn't a strong argument.
And it is comparable to immigration a little bit, because you know, what's one of the things that people fear about immigration is this kind of thing of, you hear it sometimes from your sort of Katie Hopkins types or whatever, that like, oh no, you're bringing, you know, the quote unquote undesirables in. You're bringing people in who are going to kill and rape and do all these horrendous things. But it's not statistically, it doesn't statistically square, you know. It's like, you can say, oh, if we start allowing anyone who identifies as a woman into the toilets, rapes will go up, this will happen. But the thing is, I don't see how that is being prevented now. I don't see how their being self-ID or their not being self-ID changes someone's ability to walk into any toilet and do anything they want. You can do that already, you know.
It's very weird as a feminist argument, because the implication is that outside of toilets women are safe.
Yeah,
which is demonstrably not the case. And so it's a very odd argument. Aside from the fact that countries that have self-ID don't experience the problems we're told we will have, and that we currently have a situation where trans women use women's toilets, and we don't have a significant problem, unless, like with immigration, you choose to selectively report only on extreme and disturbing cases.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to represent a minority group by the most extreme and worst elements within it. It's a very strange argument, which actually isn't surprising, because most of the times I find myself disagreeing with someone about trans issues, it isn't with a feminist, it's with a man speaking on behalf of what feminists think. It's with a gender critical cis white man like me who has read J.K. Rowling's essay and thought, well, that seems perfectly reasonable. Which is I think the main goal of that essay is to seem perfectly reasonable, and it works as long as you don't follow up on any of the people or things she references at any point in it.
And that's what I think. That's kind of what I was trying to say. That's what I mean. I think it is a well-written article in the sense that I think it achieves what it set out to achieve. And
certainly,
it's sort of, you know, Graham Linehan was at one point, he seemed to somehow, I don't know how, but he seemed to be sort of spearheading this gender critical movement. And I think at a certain point they sort of realized, oh, maybe it's not the best idea to align ourselves with this very vocal, very clearly unwell man.
I don't know how much sympathy he deserves, considering the misery he's caused. But
no, I've talked
as most of us used to be a big fan of his work in comedy, and it's sad to see. You say that he seems unwell. Yeah, you can see why they thought, wouldn't it be nice to have the highly respected millionaire author of the Magic Wizard books?
Well, it's crazy to me that he managed to somehow reach that status within that group. But then again, one thing I was going to say is that I think the gender critical movement, as it is at the moment, is... This is why I'm a bit torn on the term TERF, right? Like, it gets used as a shorthand because it is a descriptive acronym. Like, I understand, like, trans-exclusionary radical feminist, like, that is what you're being. But what I would say is, what I've noticed is a lot of the people who get called a TERF or who may even potentially self-identify as a TERF, I don't see them as a feminist to any degree. I think that's the one issue, is that a lot of these people are, I'd say, trans exclusionary, yes, radical, absolutely, but then when you hit the feminist word, it feels so far away, because a lot of these current gender critical people, they align themselves with people that don't facilitate that interest. You know, there's a lot of Christian groups, there's a lot of conservative groups. It feels like it is a very conservative movement at the moment, which is different from how it used to be.
Movement. And yeah. The arguments are conservative. There are genuine radical feminist arguments which are anti-trans.
But I think it's
very weird for them to reject the radical feminist label, the best part of TERF being the R and the F, and say, can we instead have gender critical, which doesn't have feminist in it? But it is, as you say, extremely apt. It's a better descriptor. In that it doesn't have the good bit, which was the feminist bit, and radical feminist, as you say, is a very bad descriptor of most of the people that I have found myself disagreeing with.
And this is what I talked to Vonnie about. You know, Vonnie Leclerc. Like, I had a chat with her. I did.
She's fascinating sort of... in the experience she describes. I found very interesting.
Yeah, she's amazing. I really like her, and I feel like we need more people like that who are just generally just willing to sort of say, you know, I was wrong about this thing, or I mean, not even that far, just to say, like, look, I've thought about it, and this is what I think now.
It's just Scottish people. Scottish people are so much better than the French.
More Scottish people, less French people, please.
Yes, please.
Scottish mustard. Let's look into that. but when me and Vonnie were talking about Graham Linehan, I again said, I alluded to him not being very well. And she said something along the lines of, you know, it's not an excuse. He's done a lot of harm to a lot of people. And it was just interesting because it's like, you know, I'm the one who should be saying that. And even I have this thing in me where I'm like, oh, yeah, but there's something wrong with him, right? That's how he comes across to me. Like, there's something... He seems to be going through something. He seems to be in some kind of pain. And it makes me very hesitant to make fun of him because I don't know. He just comes across as vulnerable to me. But at the same time, you're right. Like, he's done a lot of harm and he's out of his gourd. And I don't know how to approach the topic of Graham Linehan, really, because like you, I was a fan of a lot of his stuff. And it is quite a shame.
It really shows the danger of writing one really bad episode of your sitcom. If he had just not written that episode, if he had just or had considered for a moment publicly admitting that it wasn't the best episode, which is annoying because it has the internet subplot, which is one of the best subplots. His choices were, admit it wasn't the best episode ever, or go completely mad.
Well, yeah, I mean, that. I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because that is, I mean, I don't have a comprehensive knowledge about how all these things come about. And I think Graham Linehan, his sort of like his story arc is an interesting one. But that is my understanding of it as well. Like, I remember before he was a spokesperson for the feminist movement at large and an honorary lesbian, before he was those things, I remember there was a relatively small sort of like Tumblr blog that I found by Googling Graham Linehan, and it said, you know, here's Graham Linehan's examples of transphobia thus far. And it seemed clear that if this was to be believed, that it was like he hadn't really said very much on the topic up to a certain time when people started to criticize that particular episode. And then his sort of like defenses of it were lighter. They were kind of what you would expect.
In the early days,
he
said, no, it's a satire of transphobia. Yeah. Which exactly. is like, but like, if you'd done like a satire of something really bad and then started doing that thing, I would be skeptical of your ability to satirize the thing. Like if Nigel Farage did a spoof of right wing politics, I'd be a bit like, but is it a satire?
Yeah, exactly. And then he just seemed to double down on it and go into a corner and just start kicking and screaming and aligning himself with people who gave him attention. And
I remember seeing an article way before this that said Graham Linehan is a bully on Twitter. And at that time, he was being very vocal about things like abortion reform in Ireland, things I agree with. And I followed him at that time. And I thought, that's weird. What do you mean he's a bully? Yeah, he's very forceful in his opinions. But his opinions are all correct. So it didn't matter to me. And now I wish I could go back in time and find that person and just give them a look that says, like, you got it. You noticed.
Yeah, give them a wry eye.
Yeah, exactly. Remember, before Graham Linehan went mad when you called it.
The thing is, though, I mean, I was a fan of some of his stuff that he did, but I have to admit, I was never, like, I was always more of a fan of things that he was, like, adjacent to or that he, like, popped into, like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. There's a scene. But the interesting thing about the whole trans episode is, you know, like, sometimes I feel frustrated because I feel like trans people get accused of being, you know, sensitive, snowflakey types. I personally don't feel that way. You know, I have watched so many things throughout my life and enjoyed and looked past so many things that outwardly make fun of trans people and things like that. And this episode was, you know, I can't pretend that I enjoyed that aspect of it. And it's things like that that make watching certain programs with your friends and family awkward. But, you know, I didn't know anybody who was calling for the removal of the episode from 4OD or whatever, which is what ultimately happened. I'm sure there were people doing that, but what I mean is just generally, I think that trans people actually bite their tongue a lot on these things and have been doing so for a long time.
It's a very weird one. Like, there's the classic joke of, did you just assume my gender? Which is a weird satire of a thing I have never seen anybody actually say sincerely. It's a weird sort of postmodern parody that has no referent. There's no thing that is being made fun of there, except maybe something that happened once on Tumblr many years ago. It's very odd. You'd think it was something that trans and non-binary people said all the time, but they'd never say it.
Yeah, people in the real sort of world outside of the internet very rarely are the caricatures that are presented, even the other way around. You know, this gender critical thing, it's fascinating. It's why I'm so interested in finding out who has these particular views, just because, you know, online there's a line of there's like a queue of people waiting to tell you why you aren't a woman. But in real life, regardless of the fact that I do comedy sets directly after people who have what could be interpreted as transphobic jokes or whatever, very few people are willing to outwardly say to me, you know, this is how I feel about you, you know. All comedy aside, this is what I actually think. It doesn't happen in the real world. So when I do find out that somebody has these particular views, I just, you know, just make a little mental note of it, put it to the side and think, I'll just, you know, I'll be wary of you.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing of the this idea that that you if you say the wrong thing, a trans person will leap upon you aggressively, and which is something that obviously the without wanting to get into cancel culture too much, the thing that cancel culture refers to obviously does happen. You know, internet mobs do happen. I think they're an apolitical issue. I think you can be mobbed for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. The idea that it's a left-wing problem exclusively, I think, is wrong. But it can be really horrible to be mobbed, even if you deserve it and are a bad person and said a bad thing. It's obviously a really distressing thing. Mm-hmm. And there are people who will aggressively say, how dare you say this thing, which is actually a very small transgression, or perhaps they've misinterpreted it. That can happen. But in real life, the trans people I know don't want to get beaten up. So I've never seen a real world confrontation in which someone says, what did you just call me? Because most people would rather slink away and avoid the situation that they've just found themselves in.
Hearing you say earlier about how you don't feel like a gender, right? Like you don't feel this. Can you explain that to me a little bit? Because to me, that is a hard thing to understand, because I guess I am acutely aware of gender all the time. And I'm just curious how it feels for you.
I always assume that the way I feel is normal. And being a white British guy, that is quite easy to continue in that assumption for a long time in error, because it's very rarely challenged. Mm-hmm. But my girlfriend helps, so I checked with her, and she said she feels like a woman. And I thought, nah, what does that mean to feel like? And she couldn't really describe it, but she was convinced unshakably that she felt inwardly like a woman. Now, I was thinking about this, very occasionally. If I'm misgendered or get the wrong pronoun online, if I'm using a handle that isn't. I used to abbreviate Alistair to Ali quite a lot, so I would have been mistaken for a woman sometimes.
Are you admitting now to having a lot of different sock accounts that you use for various devious...
just to find out what Graham Linehan's doing.
Sure.
I would rankle if you referred to me as she. It doesn't feel particularly different than if you referred to me as Alexander, which is... Mm. Similar to which happens all the time, and so I'd hasten to correct you in both situations, because it's like you've made an error, because it doesn't. I mean, if you said I was French, that might be different, but I don't feel. Course. You know, if you say, I'm often referred to as being Scottish or Irish, and I'm not.
You'd be within your rights to punch a wall if I said you were.
I think I would. It might be that I'm not aware of my gender, because it doesn't cause me any problems.
Yeah.
And I don't experience dysphoria or the social discomforts that non-binary and trans people feel, or it might be that I'm closer to what non-binary people consider to be non-binary. I don't know.
So, like, people would assume that because I'm trans, that I must be, hyper feminine, or I must hate men, or I'm trying to, and actually. That's not the. I do hate men, but that's not the reason why. I'm kidding. I don't.
But just the French ones.
Just the French ones. Yeah. But it's hard. I think a lot of people don't feel like they fit. Generally, you know, it's hard. It's like I've never felt like I fit in male friend groups. I do feel like I fit better with female friend groups, but. Not always, everybody's different, and sometimes I feel like an outsider regardless of what I do. So it's kind of, I think we can all relate on that, unless you are a complete social butterfly and therefore a piece of shit.
Of all the phrases people would use to describe me, I think social butterfly is very low down on the list.
Right.
Anti-French bigot and social butterfly, Alistair Becker King.
Yeah, yeah. I like it. That should be your new Twitter.
I'll change the bio. When this comes out, I'll change the bio.
So do you have anything that you have always wanted to ask a trans person but have been too afraid to ask? Because now's your time. You've got a complete free speech. Get out of jail free card. You can ask me literally anything.
Oh, well, I think what I wanted to ask about was what what the experience of internal gender felt like. But I think we might have touched on that and it being difficult to describe. So I might have shot myself in the foot in terms of prepared questions by accidentally dropping it in earlier.
No, we could talk about it a little bit more, I guess. I know it's something that a lot of people wonder about, right? Because it's that thing of, you know, a cisgender woman would say, well, you know, I don't feel like a woman. Or some people say they do. Or they say, how do you know what that feels like? How can you differentiate? Well, you know, the problem with something as confusing and complicated as transgender issues, I suppose, is that I can't, you know, I don't know what that feels like. I don't know. I only have my experience, and I can sort of relate to other people. I can look at other people and think, who am I most similar to? What do I identify with? What do I like? Who do I want to hang out with? All these millions of different things. But ultimately, you know, no two people are the same. So it seems very weird to me. Anybody who has their mind made up about what anything is in that kind of, I understand that we need categorization and we need it to get by, but I don't really trust anybody who has their mind completely made up on one side or the other. So I just, in terms of this subject, in terms of gender, I suppose, I don't know. I don't know what it feels like. All I know what my life is kind of like a series of knowing what I don't want, right? And moving away from those things. And that results in me being where I am now, you know. It feels almost out of my control, you know. It's just something that has happened. And that's not particularly helpful. It's probably not a very helpful answer at all. But I don't have a rigid perception.
It's an unreasonable question. I didn't expect. It would have been great if you'd just solved the whole thing there, and we could have let everyone know that it was fixed.
It's shoes.
Shoes.
Love a shoe.
I think I do understand a bit of that more than I realised when I asked the question, because there's. The thing which helped me a lot, and to an annoying extent, the thing that helped me a lot to start to understand more about trans people was just meeting some trans people, specifically meeting trans women, and going, oh, yes, women. There's a bit in David Hume's book about human knowledge, which is, a pedantically meticulous philosophical book in which he breaks down how we're able to have knowledge of the world in a materialist way.
Yeah.
And he's rigorous in his arguments. It's a very interesting book, but also pretty dry. And there's a section where he talks about human beings have experience through our senses, and we experience the passions that rise within us, by which he just means feelings, not always just sort of, not in the sort of Italian sense, just things that arise within us. And his observation is that our sensory input is, we experience that in the same way that we experience the passions rising within us. They're things that present themselves to us, and it makes sense that we often confuse them in lots of different ways. But one of the questions is whether animals have the same sort of internal feelings that we have. And he brings it up, you know, a lot of people have asked whether animals have, you know, souls or intelligences. And all he says about that is, but they do, it's obvious, and then moves straight on. What I love about that is he's right. There's an intense moral weight behind what he says, which is, it's obvious. You have to make an effort not to realise that animals experience the world in a way that is largely similar to how we do, in terms of they enjoy food and sex and they don't like pain, and they like comfort and warmth and they don't like hardship and cold. You know, to not realise that that's true for them as it is for us, you have to make a real effort because it's obvious. And in a similar way, meeting a trans woman who is a woman and going, oh, yeah, and recognising her as a woman sort of clicked that into place, which annoys me because I think that I should have been able to work it out sort of through a priori, I don't know how to pronounce that, sort of purely philosophical investigation.
Yeah.
And it's also troubling because some trans people, I don't know whether or not passing is a big issue, but it obviously is for some trans people in their lives. Obviously, the threshold is not trans people who can who strike me as being the gender that they identify with. So I know that is not a good way of
you were moving down into it. You were moving down into a C there, but then you brought back that very interesting point there in about passing, and you've gone back up to an A minus. So you're on your way. Don't worry, the woke test is not over yet. No, it's interesting what you said about that. It reminds me, like, I always try to shoehorn a reference to the ship of Theseus into everything I talk about, but that's kind of how I feel about passing. Really, it's kind of like, it's interesting what you said. Like, you meet somebody, you perceive them as a woman, that's your reality in that moment, regardless of what you know about them, and how much you know about their past, which we don't know any. We don't expect to know things about people's pasts straight off the bat, generally. It's that kind of thing. It's like, it's synecdoche, isn't it? It's how many of these cultural signifiers of womanhood do you need in order to pass, right? Like, how many elements of a tree need to be, have an innate treeness for you to recognize it as a tree, right? It's Plato's theory of forms or whatever. So yeah, that's how I kind of think about it. I always think, yeah,
For Plato, there is an essential womanness and manness, which I think
But it's in the theory of forms.
I think for us, there probably isn't actually an essential womanness that you can dig down to, which is why there's so much fluidity.
Yeah, and I just mean it in terms of passing, because passing is
certainly we have an archetypal woman in our minds.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So and that's why, you know, so many trans people get accused of perpetuating stereotypes, right? They said, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, you're taking on these things that feminism has fought to make unimportant. You know, why are you wearing so much makeup? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And ultimately what that comes down to is it comes down to a criticism of someone's autonomy. It's like you're telling somebody that they can't look a certain way, and not realizing that maybe they just like it, but also maybe the reason why they're doing that is because it helps them to fight against what can sometimes see as an overwhelming mission, like huge odds of, like, I have to get through the day and pass in society as this other side of the binary, right? Like, I have to become and be passed as something else. And, you know, sometimes makeup and feminine clothes, they, you know, if you're out in public and you maybe don't quote unquote pass as well, but you're wearing a dress, for example, the shopkeeper in their mind is going to register that dress regardless of how much facial hair you have, right?
Yeah.
They're going to see that dress and they're going to go, oh, right, this has signified to me that this person at least knows they're wearing a dress. There must be something they're trying to communicate to me here. What do I say, sir or madam? I'm going to take a bet and go madam. That's why those quote-unquote regressive stereotypes exist, you know? And that's why people can get a misunderstanding sometimes about what trans people's agenda is, I suppose. It's not necessarily to regress anybody.
I don't want to end on a sad note, but I think the thing that does make me sad about the argument, about the arguments I hear, is that trans people seem to be hemmed in by arguments which are superficially reasonable, but incompatible with each other, except in the context of trans people not existing. What I mean by that is, yeah, you've got the argument, we can't have people with facial hair in women's toilets. And also, the counterpart argument is, we can't have trans women reinforcing stereotypes about what women are supposed to look like and
exactly.
conventional
it's a catch
beauty
22.
Standards. So there's no way to maneuver. So we can't have people who've gone through male puberty playing women's sports, and we can't allow young people to use puberty blockers to prevent trans people from going through trans women from going through male puberty, and there's no way out. And any one of those arguments, I think, can be made sincerely. But if you make all of those arguments, you can't be making them sincerely, unless your position is essentially that trans people are lying about who they are, and that they don't exist as trans people. And that's what makes me sad, because for the bystanders who have just glanced at J.K. Rowling's essay and thought that seems reasonable, any one of these arguments in isolation seems reasonable. It's only seen. They don't all seem reasonable, but no. there are reasonable sounding presentations of each of those arguments, and it makes me very sad because I guess this is why you call it dog whistly. Because if you only hear one of them, you might go, "No, that seems like a fair point," you know.
I mean, it's always been difficult to take on these really rigid descriptions of things because, like, I'm adopted. Like, that's my you know, I started as an adopted baby, and with adoption, you know, it's you have your parents, and you're told these are your parents. You know that you had biological parents, but they didn't raise you, and in fact, they were incapable of raising you. And I've always viewed my parents as my parents. I call them my parents. Legally, they are my parents. They're regarded as my parents. Most people would acknowledge, except for some very, very far out there gender critical people who I have heard say, no, they're not your parents, they never will be. But that's only to prop up their own anti-trans argument. But the fact is, in society, they are regarded as my parents, regardless of the genetics of the situation. So to me, I've always had that idea that, you know, things aren't biologically essentialist, and you can work towards other things, you know, other options, as opposed to just, no, you know, your parents are just terrible.
I think I only recently encountered the sort of adopted parent or adopted mother analogy, and it's one of the best arguments or explanatory arguments I've come across because it makes the important point. It addresses a lot of the issues because from a medical perspective, there is a significant difference between someone who was just given birth to a child and someone who has just adopted a child, and they may have differing medical needs.
And I do, like, this is the thing, when I go to the doctors,
trans women might have.
When I go to the doctors, and they always say to me, you know, any history of this in your family? And I always have to say, I don't know, I'm adopted, I've got no blood relation. So that is a medical difference between me and your average person, just in the same way as I have medical differences between cisgendered women. It doesn't change how I'm generally interpreted in society, right?
Yes, and it would be perverse to insist that adopted parents aren't parents. We recognise that adopted parents are a type of parent.
Yeah.
But I can't believe anybody would make that argument were they not defending an abstruse gender critical argument that they had already constructed.
Yeah, I just think they're very comparable things. Obviously, you could argue that they're not exactly the same, but I think it's a good analogy for it. Also, in terms of names, you know, like I've been thinking a lot lately about names and, you know, the names that we use for ourselves and things like that, and, you know, trans people don't like it when they're, you know, dead named, which is when someone calls you your old name. But I think everybody should have the option to change their name if they want to. I think when you turn 16, you should be given, or whatever age, but I think you, just as an example, 16, you could be given the option to no cost change your name by depol, be who you want to be. Because it seems weird to me that we allow ourselves to be named by other people and therefore take on the expectations of those people. It just feels counter to true autonomy. And I guess another reason why I find it weird is because, you know, before I was adopted, I had a different name. And then, so I have like two birth certificates. So then when I was adopted, I was given a new name. So now I've got another name and I don't particularly feel like... So I never really felt attached to either of those. I know. I mean, I could even go so far as to say maybe I even had another name when I was deciding what my new name would be. But I think it's something that a lot more people could benefit from, a little bit of, like, you know, I'm in control of my own life. Like, I'm making my own decisions. I'm my own person. I mean, you see it a lot on the internet. You know, people name themselves all kinds of things and are referred to as those things.
I think that's something that excites me because from a sort of, I'm going to use the word transhumanist without knowing a great deal about it, but something that I find it very depressing to see sort of Jordan Peterson type arguments popping up and biological essentialist arguments popping up, because it's like assuming global warming or coronavirus doesn't kill us, like, all of these things are going to be malleable very quickly. Mm-hmm. It would be ridiculous to start structuring human society around a sort of naturalistic fallacy that our biology is this way, and so our bodies and society must be that way. It would be mad to do that. Like the sort of the cyberpunk thing that the internet has allowed people to, in one way or another, sort of live out in the inspiring sense of cyberpunk, where they're able to construct person identities that that are more them than who they were supposed to be. I think there's something potentially exciting about that, and something quite liberating potentially.
All right. Well, I won't keep you any longer. You've given me so much time. I really appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for coming on and talking about a subject that is tricky, to say the least, and that you are not expected usually in any way to have any sort of point of view on. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for preparing me in the, what I consider to be a mock exam for the woke GCSEs.
Oh, do you want your result?
Still upcoming. I feel like I should wait and open it with all my family there.
No, I can give it to you now. It's better to pull the plaster off quickly. You exceeded the time and you have failed.
Yeah, that's fair. That is fair.
All right. Have a nice evening. Thanks.
Bye.
See you later. Bye. Well, there you go. That was my chat with Alistair Beckett King, which I really enjoyed. He gave me a lot of time to talk to him. As you know, as you heard, he did unfortunately fail the woke test, but he just didn't do enough. Just didn't do enough research, did he? You can follow Alistair on Twitter at Mr. ABK, and you should also subscribe and listen to his podcast, which is called the Lawmen Podcast. As in, like, law, you know, like, not law, as in, not like, you're under arrest, this is the law, you're in a court of law, but as in, like, oh, the, well, not even in, not even, like, the law of the land, it's, like, law, as in, like, I'm going to tell you some mysterious law, and it's all about, like, I don't know why I'm doing this, because he actually described it a lot better than I could, but I'm going to anyway. It's like a podcast where they talk about folklore, particularly like British folklore, like ghosts and gnomes and I don't know. I assume like fairies, little magic hedgehogs and stuff. It's really good. It's better than I'm doing it. I'm doing justice. But yeah, thanks for listening. I do appreciate it. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jen Ives Comedian. You can also check out jenives.net. That's my website. Also, I've just made a Patreon, or Patreon, however you say it, which is, I don't know how to do, how the URL goes. What is it? It's like flipping patreon.com/peak_trans. Because I was already a peak trans. Probably some gender critical person trying to steal my money. But no, I've made this because there's going to be a lot of extra bits to this podcast. Good bits of the conversation that I can put on as bonus bits. And also like video things and all kinds of stuff. And I am going to donate all the money to charity. At least for now. I'm having to think about what charities to put on there. But it'd mean a lot to me if you could pop over there, even if you don't decide to give any money for the charitable causes, which I can't understand why you wouldn't want to do that. I mean, what are you, some kind of greedy, uncharitable, what do you hate, people that need charity? But it would just be helpful just to get a couple of follows or a couple of likes on there. Anyway, I'm going to stop begging now. As I said, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And I hope you have a nice week. Next week there'll be another one. That's sort of how podcasts work, isn't it? There's like one week there's one, next week there's the other. I'm Jen Ives, you are you, and let's all listen to the podcast. Okay, bye-bye.